Evening. The History of Israel, Part 5, the 1920s, entitled Arabian Fights. I like the title. As always, was sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz, L'Nishmas Yona, Ben Rav Aryeh Leib. We thank them for their sponsorship. World War II reshaped the world in ways that we still feel today. The Paris Peace Conference, World War I reshaped the world. The Paris Peace Conference after World War I produced the Treaty of Versailles, which in the initial sense left Germany guilt-ridden and destitute. They actually had to sign an agreement that they were at fault for the war. They had to pay extensive reparations, agree not to have any army, all of which they subsequently violated some 15 years later, and it precipitated World War II. But World War I's aftermath redrew the map of the world. So in Europe, Austria-Hungary was divided up into Czechoslovakia, into Hungary, into Romania, into other countries. The Baltic states, which had been the core of the problem before the war, became one country, Yugoslavia, and that country remained united despite the disparate ethnic groups, because it had a series of autocratic rulers through Marshal Tito and his dictatorship. Once the dictatorship disbanded, then Yugoslavia disbanded in a wave of ethnic violence that was only resolved for the time being in the 1990s. The Baltics were realigned into a number of different states: Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Lithuania lost a lot of its territory to a Poland, which became much larger than it had been before, and Poland became independent as well. So just to give an example in our context, classic Lithuanian cities, Vilna, for example, became part of Poland before the war. My father was born in Przyjan, where my name originates. Przyjan was Lithuania before World War I. He was born in Poland, in the same city, but between the world wars. And after World War II, it became part of Belarus. So something we're not really used to in our part of the world. But the same city can be in a variety of countries depending on who's the ruler. Now, the San Remo Conference, shortly after the Paris Peace Conference, divided up the Ottoman Empire, carved it up in line with the Sykes-Picot Agreement, as well as taking into account the Balfour Declaration. It was rejected by the Turks, but nonetheless was enforced by the League of Nations that was created in the aftermath of the Treaty of Versailles in 1922. The League of Nations had already awarded the Britain the mandate over the land of Israel. And if you remember the map from last week, maybe lying around, France and Britain essentially divided up the Middle East amongst them. Syria, for example, became a French protectorate. Lebanon as well. That's why France to this day has greater influence in Syria and Lebanon than other countries. Iraq became a British protectorate, as well as the mandatory Palestine, as it was called, in the map that you have before you, which includes the land of Israel as we know today, plus Transjordan, which is close to 75-80% of what mandatory Palestine was. Now, the Emir Faisal, remember, he's the one who issued the friendly letter to Weizmann, welcoming back his Jewish brothers to the land of Israel. He had been the king of Syria, under which now became a French protectorate. He was shifted to Iraq and became the king of Iraq for the next 15 years, and his son, in fact, that dynasty existed until the 50s. And he basically, and his friendly attitudes, were rendered irrelevant because he was no longer bordering on the land of Israel. Iraq, like Yugoslavia, became a conglomerate of various ethnic groups held together by a king and then a dictator. Ethnic groups that before this had not coexisted peacefully, and as we see in our own day, now that the dictator is gone, Iraq also has descended into the same wave of ethnic violence that happened in the Slavic countries. That remains to be seen how it's worked out. If you look on the map again, also of interest to us, the black area, the little black area that denotes ceded to by British to French mandate of Syria in 1923, that is the Golan, the Ramat HaGolan, the Golan Heights. All these changes took place, including drawing up of the borders. Rebbe Chanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Damo, said already in the 1920s, quoting the Pasuk in Azinu, Yatzev Gvulos Amim L'mispar B'nei Yisrael, that God draws the borders of various countries according to the number of the Jewish people, all for our sake. Only question is, he said, is it for our benefit or is it a punishment for us? Now there's another consequence to the aftermath of World War I. Nationalism always unleashes with it violence against Jews. So after World War I, there were bloody pogroms in Ukraine and elsewhere, Poland and Russia, perhaps close to 100,000 Jews were killed. And this was one of the catalysts for the third Aliyah after World War I. In those 5 years, almost 40,000 Jews left Russia and Poland, almost all socialists, and arrived in Israel. Which brings us to this point, to the first partition of the land of Israel and the British Mandate in 1922. Now, the Balfour Declaration envisioned the Jewish state or Jewish national home encompassing what was called historic Palestine, which was on both sides of the Jordan. But the change took place. New contours were drawn by the mad cartographer, none other than Winston Churchill, who was the colonial secretary at the time, having been kicked out of as First Lord of the Admiralty after the Gallipoli disaster. So Churchill, to show you the historic dimensions of the man, essentially created today's Middle East with all its problems also. He's the one who made Iraq what it was. He's the one who drew the borders around the land of Israel, and he's the one who carved off 75-80% of historic Palestine in Transjordan, closed it to Jewish settlement, and said the Jewish national home would be restricted to the area which is only on the western bank of the Jordan River. After San Remo. Now he brought in Abdullah, a new king, a Hashemite. Abdullah was from the Arabian Peninsula. Churchill was almost like a general manager of a baseball team, trying to fill out his roster. So they had awarded the Arabian Peninsula to King Ibn Saud, hence the name, Saudi Arabia. Abdullah had been reigning in the Arabian Peninsula, so he was just traded from the Arabian Peninsula to Transjordan. So basically Churchill created a new team, a new geographic entity, Transjordan, to give Abdullah a kingdom. Abdullah was a Hashemite with no native roots in Transjordan, which to this day plagues his great-grandson, who was his namesake, Abdullah, and it plagued his father as well, King Hussein, the late King Hussein of Jordan, because they're not indigenous to the area, and the natives, whether Bedouin or other Arabs, always see them as interlopers. Nonetheless, from our perspective, what's important is that Transjordan was closed to Jewish settlement. Now, where exactly Churchill drew the border is something that we argue about to this day, both on the Israeli-Egyptian border in Sinai, as well as the Sheba farms, for example, in the northern part of Israel, on the Lebanese border. So the Arabs just claim it's Arab. This is in the news on Hayom. The Arabs claim it's Arab. Israel claims it was awarded to Syria as part of the French accession to the British mandate on the Golan. Lebanon claims it was part of their historic country border area given to them by Churchill. Well, Israel knows that it captured 1967, so Lebanon wants it back, but Israel says it conquered it from Syria, and all these things are just a pretext for violence in the northern part of Israel. Now, although the Jewish leaders would make half-hearted claims to Transjordan in the 1920s, it was never taken seriously. Their claims were not even made seriously, except by Jabotinsky, who never gave up. At Shtei Gadot LaYarden, there are two banks to the Jordan River, both the Jewish settlement. If you remember from last week as well, the Zionist proposal at the Paris Peace Conference encompassed land on the eastern bank of the Jordan as well. Nonetheless, it wasn't to be. It doesn't look like it's in our immediate future either. Real question is, why did Britain begin backtracking on the Balfour Declaration, which they did almost as soon as they adopted it as a national policy? Note, the Balfour Declaration was just a statement of policy on the part of the British government. It wasn't international law. It became sort of international law when it was embraced by the British mandate. But you remember also from last week the inherent contradiction that was in the Balfour Declaration, saying that this land would be the national home of the Jewish people, it being clearly understood, I quote, that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. And very soon everyone recognized that that was an impossibility. Most Jews at the time preferred to see the Arabs as quaint cousins who would welcome us home, hence the Faisal Weizmann Frankfurter correspondence. This was true of almost everyone. The first to anticipate problems was actually Moses Hess in the 1860s already, but no one paid attention to that. The only current person who said this would be a problem was Jabotinsky, who saw it already in the early 1900s. And most Jews also preferred to see the British as honorable interlocutors who would midwife the Jewish state into existence, even though the Balfour Declaration never spoke of a state, it spoke of a national home. What the Jews did not see clearly, which we often don't see clearly, is that nations act in line with their interests, not ours, and the British would act in line with British interests. And the Balfour Declaration, in fact, did not animate every Englishman, as it might, didn't animate every Jew for that matter, but certainly every Englishman. It had opposition in the government. When the governments changed, they were sort of warm, lukewarm, or even hostile to implementing the Balfour Declaration. Nevertheless, the Zionist organization moved to London after the war, and in 1920, Chaim Weizmann, in recognition of his efforts, was elected the president, and he became the public face of the Zionists to the world. Which brings us to the problem of the Arabs. Now, Lawrence of Arabia was not opposed to Zionism. In fact, he had advised the Emir Faisal at the Paris Peace Conference. What he did do was awaken the Arab national consciousness such as it existed. Now, it existed in the general form and not in terms of specific nations, which, of course, is worth stressing because it's a vexing problem until today. And in fact, it's one of the great mythologies that the Arabs always engender in the Middle East. There really never was, until very recently, such a thing as a specific Arab national consciousness as it relates to specific nations. That the Egyptian nation and Syrian nation and Lebanese nation, Iraqi nation, certainly a Palestinian nation as it exists. It was a pan-Arab sense that we're all Arabs, war-related, and this is our territory, and no one else can live here. But it wasn't divided into specific regions or geographical entities. The Arabs have played this game now for probably close to 90 years. When it suits them, they play the Arab card. And when it suits them otherwise, they play the individual nationalities card. As if something encroaches on Palestinian nationalism, then we are going to have for the Palestinians. But if the Palestinians agree to something, others will say, well, it's offending the pan-Arab consensus. When we speak of Arab nationalism, to be fair, we mean basically anything but Jewish nationalism. And that's how the Arabs perceived it. The British were warned by the Arabs, especially one local tribal leader, Amin al-Husseini, that a Jewish state would mean permanent unrest in the region. And worse, the Arabs in the early 1900s and 1910s had themselves, some wealthy Arab landowners had taken to selling their land to the Jews also when it suited their needs. Much like today you find in Israel also. Arabs want to make money, they sell their land to the Jews. The Effendi, those Arab landowners, did not mind receiving money from the Jews. However, when in 1920 and 21, the flames of Arab religious nationalism began to be fanned, any Jewish possession of the land was seen as an attack on the holy sites of Islam, and a new dimension also entered into existence. Now, interestingly and not surprisingly, the Arabs themselves were told by a British mandatory official in Yerushalayim that disturbances of, I quote, sufficient violence would cause ultimately the British to abandon the Balfour Declaration. And already in March 1920, you have the first wave of violence in the land of Israel perpetrated by the Arabs, the first of many times, in fact, that violence has helped the Arabs achieve their goals. You know, the liberals have a notion that violence is counterproductive to achieving your political ends. The Arabs, it's exactly the opposite. For 85 years, violence has always achieved their goals if sustained over a long enough period of time. The Arabs began in March 1920 with attacks on Jewish settlements in the north. One famous figure we met last week for the first time, Yosef Trumpeldor, headed to the north to defend some of the kibbutzim there. Trumpeldor was a veteran of the Russian army, fought in the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, lost his left arm, but kept fighting, never left the army. Then, as you recall from last week, came to Israel, organized the Zion Mule Corps, the first Jewish fighting force, and then became one of the heads of the Jewish Legion, along with Jabotinsky, which he felt would ultimately liberate the land of Israel. So with Jabotinsky, he was a fighter, he was an Aliyah activist, he went to defend the Galil Elyon, the Upper Galilee, where the settlements were under siege, at Tel Chai. During the siege of Tel Chai, he was shot in the stomach and died. Famous last words, as his life was ebbing away, he said, "Ein davar tov lamut ba'ad artzeinu." It's nothing. It's good to die for our land. And that became a mantra of the Zionists. You know, in the last 10, 15 years, as the post-Zionist movement has arisen in Israel, they have revised everything, and now some Israeli school children have thought that he didn't die saying Tov Lamut Ba'ad Artzeinu, he died cursing in Russian at his unfortunate fate. But we never know, and certainly the legend of Trumpeldor lived after him. He became a legend on the left because of this notion of the Jewish fighter, a one-armed Jewish fighter, a certain mystique. He had one arm, Dayan had one eye, and yet they continued fighting, which really is symbolic of the sense of a people not really trained in warfare for two millennia and now taking up arms. So the left saw him as a patriot, and he still celebrated as that. But the right saw him as the embodiment of the vision of Israel, which would reclaim and liberate the state of Israel. The fighter, the activist, the aliyanik, the one who would fight against any enemy in order to retain the land of Israel. As an ally of Jabotinsky, he was embraced by the right, and that actually was the name of the Beitar movement. Beitar was named not for the ancient city of Beitar, which was destroyed, but Beitar is an acronym for Brit Trumpeldor, the Trumpeldor Covenant, founded in 1923. And that became the right-wing Zionist youth movement. That was in March. On April 1st, you had major riots, even a pogrom in Yerushalayim. For obvious reasons, the old Yishuv, which had absolutely no defense, was always attacked by the Arabs in the 20s and the 30s as well. In the old city of Yerushalayim, 9 Jews were killed and dozens were wounded. The British police, just as in the north, in the old city of Yerushalayim, did nothing for 5 days. And that became a pattern as well. Let the Arabs vent, and then we'll step in and protect the Arabs for any type of Jewish retaliation. The governor of Yerushalayim then, an Englishman named Ronald Storrs, was a noted Arabist, but that policy was carried out even by his successors. And in fact, that quote-unquote sufficient violence did cause the British to abandon the implementation of Balfour. Now, when the pogrom came to Yerushalayim, Jabotinsky activated the Jewish Legion. He was arrested, sentenced to 15 years at hard labor in Akko prison. Amin al-Husseini, who had instigated the violence, by the way, one of the things that he said was that the Jews are going to destroy the Arab holy places in Yerushalayim, which is, again, a refrain that we hear until today. came up in 1996 when the Hashmonim tunnel was opened in Yerushalayim, and the Arabs claim that it is being dug under the Temple Mount in order to destroy Al-Aqsa. So that, in fact, was the founding moment of the Al-Aqsa Brigades, which vexes us until today. But that type of lie, you all know. I remember standing here in the hall, in our lobby, with Christy Whitman, explaining to her that the Hashmonah, pointing to the Kotel picture, pointing out where Al-Aqsa is, all on the right of the picture, and the Hashmonah tunnel far to the left. I said it's about, if you just go by the picture, it's maybe 50 yards in a picture towards the left. It made no difference. When she spoke on television that night about these matters, she said, no, the Arabs are afraid they're trying to undermine the Temple Mount. Be that as it may, that year, in May, the British appointed Herbert Samuel, a Jew, as the first British High Commissioner of Palestine. They appointed a Jew to appease the Jews, and the Jews were very happy at first. He tried, but mostly disappointed the Jews. Of course, he disappointed the Arabs. But he received conflicting messages from his home office, and he was forced to deal with Arab unrest. And probably in retrospect, the main problem that Samuel had was that he was a Balfour literalist. He wanted there to be a Jewish state that would not prejudice the rights of the Arabs. And as Paul Johnson noted in his history, that's trying to square the circle. And that pleased nobody. The Arabs always suspected that he was pro-Jewish because he was a Jew. And Samuel bent over backwards not to favor the Jews because he was a Jew, also something we're familiar with in the government. He mainly tried to appease the Arabs, but he did so unsuccessfully. One thing that he did in the summer, July, was he pardoned Jabotinsky. His 15-year sentence was commuted to 3 years, but he also pardoned and welcomed back Haj Amin al-Husseini, brought him back to Israel, and in 1921, he appointed al-Husseini the Grand Mufti of Yerushalayim, another big mistake. The Grand Mufti, by the way, was a title that Samuel created. It wasn't like there was some historic nobility that was conferred upon him. He wanted an Arab leader, Samuel did, that he could talk to. An Arab leader that can deliver, as the lingo goes. And it's really the exact same thing today. When I say today, I mean today, this very day. Same thing with Arafat or with Abbas. If the Arabs are against something, then the nations of the world look for one Arab leader to talk to represent them. So today, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, Haniyeh, the Hamasnik, said that he renounces and will never fulfill the peace treaties that Israel signed in the 1990s. At the same time, Secretary of State Rice announced there's a summit meeting in a few weeks with Abbas and with Olmert. Because the Prime Minister, you can't talk to him. So you'll talk to the Arab who wants to talk, you'll sign an agreement with him, you'll accept whatever concessions are to be accepted, and you'll leave it for your successor to deal with the problems that rises for the Jews. Worse about al-Husseini, he's one of the great Jew haters of the century. In a century that was notorious for Jew haters, he would end up spending World War II in Berlin trying to convince Hitler to bring the final solution to the land of Israel as well. In the interim, he only fomented strife. This type of religious hatred that Amin al-Husseini had died with him, but he lived into the 50s, but it was revived in the 1980s with Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran, a religious hatred that is basically an unassuageable grievance. There's nothing that you could say to convince them, nothing. So negotiations are completely futile and fruitless because you're on a different wavelength entirely. More riots in 1921 in Yafo, even more Jews were killed, and sporadic bloody riots would become the norm of Jewish life. Now what Samuel did to appease the Arabs, and this became their main request for the next 25 years, was to restrict Jewish immigration. And Samuel, in fact, in 1922, 1921, halted temporarily Jewish immigration to the land of Israel, and then he severely restricted it. Even in 1921, a boat had docked at Yafo of refugees who had come from Europe and taken the ship from Istanbul, and it was sent back to Istanbul. A very eerie portent of things to come some 20 years later. But they were sent back. In 1922, Churchill issued the first of what was called the White Papers, restricting Jewish immigration, again saying that he subscribes to Balfour, but Jewish immigration to the land of Israel cannot exceed what he said was the economic capacity of the land to absorb it. That number became 16,500 per year. He said there would be a Jewish national home in Palestine, but that Arab rights and culture would be safeguarded as well. Illegal immigration began also at the same time, but more importantly, and here you come to one of the great controversies that we wrestle with today, Arab immigration was never limited. So the wonderful book, a classic book in the area by a journalist named Joan Peters, called From Time Immemorial, that all Jews should read. She started writing a book. She wasn't necessarily sympathetic to Jews, started doing her research on the plight of the Arab refugee, and immediately she was able to debunk the myths that the Arabs have propagated now for close to 75 years, that Arabs were displaced by Jews in the land of Israel. Her basic thesis was that Arabs displaced Jews more than Jews displaced Arabs. And she did extensive research documenting the various population surveys going back to the mid-19th century. So for example, in 1893, 60,000 Jews lived in the land of Israel with 55,000 Muslims and 38,000 Christians. So in fact, the Arabs were not there from, that's the title of her book, time immemorial, but rather the Arab population grew when they came from foreign lands because of the jobs and opportunities that Zionist development produced, especially in the 1910s and especially in the 1920s. When Jewish immigration was restricted in the 1920s, the survey, she says, prove that two Arabs came to the land of Israel for every Jew that came to the land of Israel. And the later population disparity, especially 1948, resulted from this very imbalance. Not to mention, for every Arab refugee caused in 48, there was at least one, maybe more than one, Jewish refugee from an Arab land, but that's for another lecture. You find, therefore, almost all the Arabs who claim to be Palestinians, for centuries, they came from other lands. I laugh every few months to read the newspaper about a famous family in Shechem, the Al-Matsri family. So we all speak a little Arabic because we speak Hebrew. Al-Matsri means the Egyptian. So the family came from Egypt in the early 20th century. They settled in Shechem. Once they settled there, they claimed to be there for 500 years already. And this is the norm. The myth that the land was theirs for centuries and populated by them, she explodes. The fact is most Arabs were nomads or Bedouins and had no national consciousness. The Arabs, in all the years of their residence in the land of Israel during the Ottoman Empire from 1517 until 1917, founded exactly one city. You know the city? Ramla. That's it, not Ramallah, Ramla. That was the only city they founded in all those years. There is a myth of Palestinian national consciousness that rose in direct proportion to Jewish achievement and is primarily anti-Jewish in nature, hence the irony with which Jews lived in the first half of the century. Jews embraced the designation as Palestinians. Arabs resented being called Palestinians. They want to be called Arabs, or to be more specific, Southern Syrians. Because as we mentioned before, the Syrians claimed the territory of the land of Israel based on their interpretation of the Hussein McMahon correspondence. So they recoiled from the term Palestinians. They only adopted it around the time of the Six-Day War. Even Churchill conceded in 1939 that in the previous 20 years, the Arabs had crowded into the country and multiplied. And the Arab growth was only because Jewish population was restricted and Arab population was not. Not to mention as well that Arabs were often counted multiple times because being nomadic, they would move from the north to the south, from the east to the west in the land of Israel. Peters notes, just as an example, In a few months, in 1934, more than 30,000 Arabs came from one town in Syria, Harun, which might be the ancient city of Haran, for all I know, where Avram stopped on his way to Eretz Israel. 30,000 in a few months in 1934 came to Israel from Harun in Syria at a time when Jews were basically not allowed to enter the land of Israel. The bottom line, unfortunately, is that nobody really cares anymore about this. This is considered ancient history. Even in Israel, the seculars and the post-Zionists have swallowed the Arab propaganda with all the guilt that it engenders, that they have driven the Arabs out of the land. But truth, emes me'eretz tzimach, truth always has a way of sprouting, and it's important to know the truth. People have tried over the last 12 years to discredit Joan Peters' research by referring to it as the discredited Joan Peters book, period. It hasn't been refuted, but they just say it's been discredited, and therefore the Arab propagandists will just refer to it as discredited without saying anything. So while Jewish population was curtailed to a maximum of 16,500 a year, the Arab immigration to the land of Israel swelled the ranks and gave the Arabs a sense of confidence. Now, with the Arabs now on the offensive, what do the Jews do? We fight amongst ourselves. Now, the oddity, of course, was that the Zionist organization, the World Zionist Organization, was not located in Zion, but in London in 1920. That would change very quickly with dramatic consequences on a number of fronts. And the question became, I guess we still deal with this question today, who leads? Who should be in charge? And that became a dominant issue in the early part of the 20s. As in, who elected the Zionists to represent anyone in the land of Israel? They don't even live here. In 1918, after the war ended, Weizmann sent what he called a committee of delegates, including himself, to investigate conditions in the land of Israel and to take over the leadership of the Yishuv. The response of the old Yishuv was, Mi samchal ish sar v'shofet aleinu, who appointed you? We're living here, we are here, you're a British citizen living in London. Secular Zionism was bad enough, and now they want to assume control of the Yishuv. The old Yishuv, you recall again, did not have an official leader at this time. Sonnenfeld was not appointed. It had only recently, during the war, lost its majority status in the land of Israel. It lost control over the relief funds that were coming from the outside during the war. It lost the financial support of Russian Jews on which it was dependent because of the Bolshevik Revolution, and now was in danger of losing its political standing and becoming more and more dependent on the Zionists. Weizmann set out to neutralize or marginalize this force, what he called disparagingly this cloisel. Cloisel, like a little cloise, a little shtiebel. He said, as long as this cloisel exists, there's no hope for our institutions to achieve control over the country. So he tried to buy them off first. Many Jews were destitute and desperate enough that they distanced themselves from Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld and the old ways and tried to make common cause with the what was called the Vad Lumi, the National Council. Consequently, in Yerushalayim, a city council was formed shortly after Allenby arrived in December 1917. Only five of the 15 city councilors were members of the old Yishuv, even though they were majority of the population. The makeup of that council was not at all based on elections or based on population, but just based on what would serve the interests of the Zionist organization. So the Haredim then, the old Yishuv, formed a rival council called the Vad Ha'ir HaAshkenazi. Weizmann persisted. For a long time, the Zonnenfeld would not even meet with him, so as not to give him any legitimacy. They finally met, and Weizmann said to Rabbi Chaim Zonnenfeld that the Zionist organization would fund the yeshivas of the old Yishuv, as long as minor changes were made to the curriculum. Oh, that was a red flag. And Reb Chaim was a tough fellow. He said to Weizmann, we wouldn't listen if a respected Rav came to us and told us to change the curriculum, much less a Machal Shabbos before Hesiel. Those were fighting words. But Weizmann developed a grudging respect over the years for Reb Chaim and what he called his pure truth. And Reb Chaim represented the pure truth of Torah. Reb Chaim said to him once in a casual conversation that in fact we, the old Yishuv, we're the true Zionists, not you. Because we're the ones who say every day, "V'techazeno einenu b'shum chol etzion barachamim." Our eyes will behold the return of God, the return of the Shekhinah to Yerushalayim, to Tzion. So we're the true Zionists. They boycotted the elections to the Jewish Assembly, which became the first governing body in the land of Israel. In 1919, there was another election in Yerushalayim for a Vat Ha'ir. So the election of Vat Ha'ir took place, and they elected who they elected. Then they held elections for their rival Vat Ha'ir Ashkenazi, and they had twice as many voters voting for the Vat Ha'ir Ashkenazi as voted in the general election. They soon adopted a different name, by which they're known today, and that's the Edah Haredis. And that became the representative of the old Yishuv, really Ad Hayom. Their bottom line political philosophy was that they did not want an independent state, and not because of the Satmar idea that you can't have it before the coming of Mashiach, although some were motivated by that, but generally because they saw the Zionist movement as secular and anti-Torah, and therefore to have the Zionists in charge would be anathema to Torah. Now, Rav Yosef Chaim compromised and met with Weizmann. Because of that, a new faction arose that was against him. They weren't anti-Zionist enough, so a new faction arose in 1923, known as Natura Karta. And Natura Karta refused any dealings at all with any Zionist, with anyone who would talk to any Zionist, with anyone who would talk to anyone who would talk to any Zionist ad infinitum. And that exists until today as well. They don't mind talking to people who want to kill Jews, but if you talk to the wrong Jew, they won't talk to you. Now, there was a search on for a leader, a representative. The British had the idea, was embraced by Rav Kook, actually, since the Muslims had it, and the Turks had recognized the institution of the Chacham Bashi. The British suggested the establishment of what they called the chief rabbinate. And the chief rabbinate would have included an appeals based in. Now, there was a controversy also in 1920-21, and because the Zionists wanted to establish a secular court system in Yerushalayim. Old Yishuv was apoplectic over that. Rav Kook eventually reluctantly agreed to it, probably regretted it. Rav Chaim Zonnefeld opposed it. Meanwhile, Rav Chaim was still opposing the position as Rav of Yerushalayim when Rav Kook was appointed by the Vat Ha'ir, the general Vat Ha'ir, as the Rav of Yerushalayim. Rav Kook came back from London after World War I, went to Yafa, and right away was elevated within a short time to be the Rav of Yerushalayim. When Rav Kook accepted the position as Rav of Yerushalayim, then Rav Zonnefeld accepted the position as Rav Ha'ir, really at that time, Rav of the Edah HaCharedis. Now, there are a number of problems with the institution of the chief rabbinate. Some exist until today as well. The main objection always is Mi Barosh. Who is it going to be? If it's not me, then obviously it's someone who's less worthy than me. So who can it be? Another problem was, and it's a problem until today, the chief rabbinate is voted upon by many voters who are secular. There's a council that votes. The council is made up of the political parties who appoint people, and there are many secular Jews voting. So it doesn't necessarily attract the greatest Talmud Chacham, or the most outspoken person, or the most dynamic leader, or the Rav who can make the greatest impact on Jewish life. On the contrary, it's usually someone who has a political sense, who's more tactful, who doesn't try to make waves, who speaks in flowery language that will not antagonize anybody. That might be the strength of the institution, but that's also the weakness of the institution as well. And I think most everyone would agree it's never really lived up to its hopes and its expectations. Rav Kook became the Ashkenazi chief rabbi in 1921. Rav Yaakov Meir became the Sephardi chief rabbi, the Rishon Lezion. But the institution itself further marginalized the old Yishuv. Other controversies they had to deal with. Women's suffrage, for example. When do women get the right to vote in America? 1918. So it was on the agenda. Ralph Cook opposed it. Rav Zonenfeld opposed it. The Zionists, of course, wanted it and pushed it through. Zionism itself was a matter of a great disagreement between Ralph Cook and Rav Zonenfeld. They're on different wavelengths. And if you study any of Ralph Cook's works, you recognize that he's a very unique soul. And he writes things that are pristine and pure and true, but a person with a different background just takes them the wrong way. And he was always being, not misquoted, but misunderstood. Rav Cook, for example, wrote an essay, you find it in Ma'amarei HaRiyah, praising sports and athletics. It'll build healthy Jewish bodies. We need healthy Jewish bodies. The old Yishuv, this was Apikarsus, ball spilling, Bittul Torah. How could a rogue tell people to play ball? Rav Cook reluctantly supported the establishment of Hebrew University and in fact was cajoled into speaking at the dedication at Har Tzofim in 1925 on one condition. It was guaranteed by Weizmann. He in principle, he supported it, a center of secular learning under Jewish auspices. Yafta Elokim Liefes, Vishkom Baal Hashem. So in principle, it sounded good. He asked Weizmann for one commitment, that there not be a Department of Biblical Criticism at Hebrew University. And Weizmann guaranteed it to him, and within a few weeks it became clear that Weizmann had lied, just lied to him. And Rav Cook later wrote that he regretted attending the opening, but it made no difference. And if you read, you also see it in his Sfarim, in Ma'amarei HaRiyah, you read his dedication speech at Hebrew University, beautiful about the Jewish people, and the Torah, knowledge, etc. What it could be a different aspect of Ki Mitzil Teitei Torah. But nonetheless, Rav Cook was almost naive in his belief in the purity of intentions of everyone with whom he came into contact. Old Yishuv, now the Eda Haredis was scrambling to try to remain relevant and protect their interests. In 1920, they appointed as their spokesman a very interesting Jew, Dr. Yisrael Yaakov Dehan. Dehan grew up in a very large, 17 siblings, religious family in the Netherlands, and he went off the derech, became completely assimilated, even married a non-Jew. He became a lawyer and a diplomat for the Queen of the Netherlands. Once in the Dutch palace, he overheard an anti-Jewish slur that he thought was directed at him, and so became his return back to Shmiras HaMitzvos. And Dehan was a brilliant fellow, fluent in many languages, a brilliant writer and orator, and he came to Israel in 1910, fell in first with Rav Cook, 1920 met Rav Yochanan Zonenfeld and was swept away, became a non-Zionist and became the political secretary of the Eda Haredis. He was used by the Eda Haredis to negotiate with the British. More on that in a few moments. Now the British favored, wanted there to be one Jewish body to represent all Jews, but it wasn't to be. We all know how Jews love organizations. There's nothing we're better at than creating new organizations. Actually, Agav Urchah, that's how the Conference of Presidents arose in the 1950s. John Foster Dulles was tired with meeting with the presidents of every Jewish organization separately, and he said, there has to be one group to speak to. He doesn't have time to meet with everybody. So that's how the conference was formed, with one executive vice president and one president, and he represents the Jews. So the British wanted a similar thing. It wasn't to be, for obvious reasons, but other organizations formed. In 1920, the Histadrut was formed, and its leader, in 1921, became Weizmann's great rival, that is David Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion was born in 1886 in Plansk, in Russia. His father was a member of Chovei Tzion. He himself was twice arrested during the Russian Revolution of 1904, and he right away went to Israel. So he came to Israel at the age of 19. As the legend goes, he worked in the orange groves of Petah Tikva and the wine cellars of Rishon LeZion. He joined Pohal Eitz Tzion, which had a Marxist bent, and he himself had very strong, strong socialist leanings. He left in 1912 to study law in Turkey, And there he got caught up when the war started, and he supported the Turks in World War I until the Turks began persecuting the Zionists in Israel. Back in Israel, he was deported by the Turks to Egypt. He wound up in, he opposed Trumpeldor, by the way, and the Zion Mule Corps, because he said, you know, Jews are not fighters. Went in 1917 to New York City, and here he married his wife Paula, allegedly without klippa of the Kiddushin. They weren't married kalacha. But he did join the Jewish Legion in 1918 back in Egypt, and then he was part of Allenby's force conquering Israel. He was well known. In 1920, he became the Secretary General of the Histadrut, and that became his power base. Weizmann was the president of the World Zionist Organization. Ben-Gurion, the Secretary General of the Histadrut. Histadrut was not just a labor union. The Histadrut was a worker society in a ways that we can't even imagine today, except for the fact that its influence is still very strong in Israeli life. Histadrut was not just a union, but it had its own settlements. It had its own industry. It had a pervasive political indoctrination of all its members. Ben-Gurion invented what became known in Israel as vitamin P, protexia. You want a job, you want a loan, you want a home, until the 1980s. You want a telephone in less than 12 months, then you need to support us politically. You need to embrace our ideology, or you'll be in the political and social midbar, which is what happened to many, many Jews over the years. Histadrut organized its own food cooperative, Tenuva, its own bank, Bank HaPoalim, a workers' bank, its own healthcare system, Kupat Cholim. You have to remember Histadrut to participate and benefit from Kupat Cholim. Its own industrial conglomerate, Soel Boner, its own political party, Mapai, and of course the same people involved and formed the Histadrut founded the Haganah in 1920. The Haganah was the successor to HaShomer, which was a Jewish defense group, and think about the name. The purpose of Haganah was not to undertake offensive operations against the Arabs, but simply to defend the Jewish settlements or Jews in the land of Israel when they were under attack. It became a powerful force. So you have Weizmann on one side and Ben-Gurion on the other side, and you have Rav Kook and you have the Eda Haredis, and everyone is trying to vie for supremacy in society, which leads to one of the great tragedies almost unknown in the Jewish world, although it should be better known because we've seen other recurrences of this phenomenon. In 1922, the Asifat HaNivcharim, the National Congress, which was an agency of the Vada Lumi, passed a regulation declaring that there would be one body, namely them, that would represent all Jews. The Orthodox resisted. The resistance was led by Gudas Yisrael, which is based in Vienna. They convinced the British not to accept this. The British agreed, but a similar plan was approved in early 1924 that recognized the Vada Lumi as the representative of the Jews of the land of Israel. Vada Lumi would later be merged into the Jewish Agency and take on that name in the 30s. Now, the Orthodox protested. They didn't want to be linked to the Vada Lumi. The Eda Haredis did not. So in June 1924, they decided to dispatch Yaakov Yisrael Dahan to England to negotiate with the new conservative government and try to have that plan annulled. The night before he was to leave, that's June 30th, 1924, Dahan was leaving the minion at Shari Tzedek Hospital for Davening Maariv, the old Shari Tzedek. He hit Rehov Yafo, and there he was shot to death by an unknown assailant. He was killed. It only came out in the 60s in a book, Toldot HaHaganah, that in fact it was a Haganah hit that was authorized by Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who later became the second president of Israel, that directed the deputy commander of Yerushalayim to have him killed so as to destroy the influence and end the diplomatic efforts of the Eda HaHaredis, essentially to silence the Orthodox separatist movement, and in fact it did. If there's one thing the Eda HaHaredis could not compete with, it was with violence. It was the first, but wouldn't be the last, political murder in the land of Israel. The book came out in 1985 that detailed the whole thing, called The First Political Murder in the Land of Israel. It's available in Hebrew. In fact, they tracked down the commander, Avram Tahomi, who by then was living in Hong Kong, who's the one who, or he got two Russian immigrants actually do the murder. He lived in Hong Kong. He died in 1990. Now, Weizmann was contesting on the left with Ben-Gurion. At the same time, he was contesting on the right with Jabotinsky. But before that, he had to marginalize someone else, and that was Louis Brandeis. Brandeis represented the American Zionists, and Brandeis felt that once the Balfour Declaration was enacted, that was the ultimate political success, because the Jews were guaranteed a national home. Brandeis didn't care whether it became a state or not a state, as long as Jews had a place to live. Weizmann basically kicked him out of the movement, and since then, Americans are almost exclusively limited to fundraising. Brandeis was also hurt, if you think about it, because his contact was Wilson. He was close to Wilson, and Woodrow Wilson, the president, who had appointed him as an associate justice of the Supreme Court. But Wilson had a stroke in mid-1990, and also hard to believe. The last 14, 15 months of his presidency, he could not talk, could not move. A fact that was unknown to the people. His wife did the speaking to him. We found many great people. His wife and his aide. They basically ran the government. But Brandeis lost his contact, and therefore he lost his influence on the world Zionist movement as well. Jabotinsky became an opponent. I mentioned last week, Jabotinsky felt Weizmann trusted the British too much. He was right about that. He felt that the Weizmann and the Zionists had adopted the British long-term plan for the Jewish national home, which he thought, and history proven correct, would never happen if the Jews didn't fight for it. When Churchill in 1922 allowed Jews again to come into the land of Israel, if the economic capacity of the land supports them, he agreed, but too soon. What Churchill decreed was that only Jews who could bring with them $2,500 in cash, they could enter the land of Israel. Weizmann didn't mind, because he didn't want Ostjuden, he wanted wealthy cosmopolitan Jews. Jabotinsky was horrified when he saw the fine print, and he began already in 1923 illegal immigration to the land of Israel. That same year, 23, Jabotinsky split with the Zionist movement. He resigned. He founded a rival movement in 1925 called the Revisionist Zionists. He rejected socialism. He rejected any accommodation with the British or with the Arabs. Shtei Gadot LaYarden. He founded Beitar. He mobilized Jewish youth throughout Europe. He became a world traveler. He was a mesmerizing orator. Reports of the age say that when he spoke before the Zionist congresses, before he was banned, his speech was the highlight of the Congress. People would come to hear him. He's a dominant thinker. The British banned him from the land of Israel a few times, did not want him to come back. Ben-Gurion hated him with a passion, already called him in the 30s Vladimir Hitler. Also something that, came in the 90s and the O's as well, tossing around the Hitler reference, but he was a gadfly. Worse, he was usually right, almost always right. I can't think of one prediction that Jabotinsky made that turned out not to be right. He said the British would renege on Balfour, and in fact they did. Jabotinsky lived, as few people do, long beyond his time. He spawned the Chirut Party and Likud, and in a very real sense, spawned the JDL as well. The Jewish Defense League was modeled on Beitar and on the Rosh Beitar, which was Zev Jabotinsky himself. Ad Hayom, Likud headquarters is called Mitzudat Zev in Tel Aviv. He said he would break the Histadrut. In fact, it probably broke him. He was ostracized, and that fissure in society really affects Israel until today. Became even more pronounced when Menachem Begin became his disciple and then his successor after he died. He died in 1940. You recall that Herzl's body was brought from Vienna immediately, 1948-49. Ben-Gurion refused to let him be buried in Israel. Refused. And it took Ben-Gurion to leave office finally in the early 60s. 1966, he was buried on Har Herzl. I remember my very first visit to Israel, 1969. His was the first grave he visited. He's buried in the same vicinity as the old graves of the Jewish people. So had all this turmoil in the 20s. All these groups competed for the power and for the allegiance of the people, both Jewish and non-Jewish governments as well. You had Weizmann and the Zionist establishment. You had Ben-Gurion and the Mapai. You had Jabotinsky and the revisionists. You had Rav Kook and the religious Zionists. You had Rav Sonnenfeld and the non-Zionists. And the same parties exist until today. It's only 85 years. Not to mention the Jewish non-Zionists across the world who were skeptical, very wary of a Jewish homeland, which they saw as inhibiting their assimilation and endangering their standing, their existence somehow in the lands of their residence, the old dual loyalty accusation. While this was going on and we were fumbling our way, the Arabs were focused on one task, not nation building, but nation aborting. That is another myth that they have successfully convinced the world of. They never attempted to build a Palestinian state. Their whole thrust was just to abort the nascent Jewish state. All their political efforts in the 20s and the 30s had one goal, to thwart Jewish immigration. And whether it was political pressure, whether it was violence, that's what they would do. A state, they knew correctly, would only come into existence with Jews. It would not come into existence without Jews. And the way to rivet the world's attention would be, then as now, through savage acts of violence and butchery, such that people would recoil in horror and look for ways just to stop the bloodshed, regardless of what the political outcome has to be. And that's exactly today's tactic in Iraq. It's the exact same thing. Have violence of such an extreme level, such an extraordinary level, turned on each other so you can't tell the parties apart necessarily, just so people should say, okay, enough. And that was their tactic in the land of Israel as well in the 1920s. By the end of the 20s, the Jewish population was at about 160,000, but people came and left. The net immigration, so the total number was about 16,500 per year, aside from illegal immigration, but the net growth was estimated at only 8,000 because of the poverty, because of the danger, and the political insecurity. Yom Kippur 1928, the Vad Ha'ir, the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim, placed a mechitza at the Kotel. First time the Kotel had a mechitza. You see the old pictures, there's no mechitza there. Couldn't do it, but they weren't the Baalei Bayis. The mechitza at the Kotel touches off Arab rioting, because they say, now the Kotel, and tomorrow they'll destroy the mosques. Again, the same refrain. The British side with the Arabs, and Jews are beaten. Tension builds, and it builds for months, until in August of 1929, riots break out across the country, especially in Yerushalayim and Hebron. In Hebron, Yerakot, 67 Jews are murdered, but butchered. Many Talmidim of Yeshiva Slobodka, which had moved from Slobodka to Yerushalayim and 25 Yerushalayim to Hebron, including a couple of American students who'd gone to learn in Israel for the year. 67 were killed, many more grievously injured. Anyone who visits Hebron, you always stop at the museum of the old Yeshuv of Hebron, and you see pictures, people missing fingers and hands, limbs chopped off. No guns were used. The Arabs only used knives and axes to kill people. Before order was restored in the land of Israel, just two cities, the pogroms elsewhere, 133 Jews were killed across the country. But no immediate answers in sight for the Jews. There were too many different views. There was no agreement even on whether the British were helpful or harmful, could be trusted or not trusted. There were no firm plans to take statehood or the quest for statehood to the next level. Weizmann was content to rely on the British, and of course, there was no anticipation, except again by Jabotinsky almost alone, of the dangers ahead for the Jews of Europe in the 1930s, and that's next time, the gathering storm. Thank you very much.